This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. According to the Bible, God gave Moses the Ten Commandments atop Mount Sinai, a moral code that defined our relationship with God and with each other. After all these years, they're still making news. Any day now, the Supreme Court will rule on whether a display of the commandments on government property violates the separation of church and state. There are passionate arguments on both sides. A book published today argues that both sides are missing the point. As individuals, we ignore the meaning of these moral guideposts. As a society, we risk the collapse of the values that hold our communities together. We risk moral ruin. Losing Moses on the Freeway is the latest book by Chris Hedges, who many of you will recognize as a longtime war correspondent for the New York Times and other organizations, including NPR News. He's also the son of a minister and a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. Later in the program, we'll look at a new survey that reports troubling findings about the mental health of Americans. But first, the Ten Commandments and America. Whether you're religious or not, do you use the Ten Commandments as a guide? Is there one in particular that challenges you? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Chris Hedges is now a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and teaches in the Program for American Studies at Princeton, and he joins us from our bureau in New York. Chris, nice to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Neil.
Why are the Ten Commandments still relevant today?
Well, they were formed as sort of the first ethical guidelines set up by a settled community to regulate community itself, to regulate ethical behavior. And I think what's so interesting about them is that they deal with perhaps the severest violations we suffer as human beings. Only two of the commandments are incorporated into our legal system, the prohibitions against theft and murder. The other things that the commandments deal with are much more nebulous. Our relationship with God, our relationship with each other, issues of envy, issues of greed, issues of dishonesty, adultery. I think that the wisdom of the commandments, which have been with us for 6,000 years, are that when they're honored, they may not protect us from evil, but they protect us from committing evil. And that societies that ignore the commandments, that feel that they can engage in those violations without any kind of penalty, are societies that tend to collapse. And I think that looking at American society through the prism or the lens of the commandments is a fascinating way to reflect back on our own moral shortcomings. In fact, many of the idolatrous drives, I think, that permeate American culture.
That's one of the you write a chapter for each of the commandments, and people may take issue with your definitions. But on idolatry, you seem to come right down on the line of the golden calf there.
Yes. Idolatry is, Augustine the theologian wrote that there are only two forms of worship, either worship of God or worship of the self. And that idolatry, that at its core, that's what idolatry really is. It's about the worship of the self. And I think that's correct. It's about the exaltation of ourselves as a people, as a nation. And these are false covenants. They can be covenants of gender, covenants of race. There are innumerable covenants that we set up that are false covenants. But in the end, that's what they are. Mm-hmm. And idolatry is something, especially in a wealthy consumer society, that we're constantly enticed towards. It's very hard to resist. I mean, everything from government to advertisers to the media itself knows how to get us to respond. And when we respond emotionally to what they want, it's often it may be in their interest, but it's not always in ours.
But the exemplar that you use in this chapter on idolatry is, you mentioned television and all those other things, but the example you use is a woman who followed the band Phish.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting about that, and, all of these chapters, are brought down to the street level. I just think it's, as a writer, it's where you learn, and the chapters are spun out from that. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about Phish, it could have been the Grateful Dead, or it could have been, some big Fortune 500 company. Or what it is all the followers in Phish thought they were escaping you know, the decadence of modern culture and creating a community based around this band. And of course, I took the extreme sort of fish heads who mm-hmm. went from city to city in a kind of nomadic caravan and lived in parking lots and stuff. And what they were seeking was that ecstatic experience, that sensual high that came often with the aid of drugs in these concerts. And so that at the very moment that they thought that they were creating a new community, what they were really doing is replicating the worst of the consumer society, where people leap from sensual experience to sensual experience. And I think the wisdom of the commandments is that one only achieves integrity and perhaps happiness, we can debate over, you know, the definition of human happiness, by sacrifice, by self-sacrifice for the other, by giving life to the other. That is really what the commandments are about. It's about denying our own impulses, those impulses that propel us forwards, often very self-destructive impulses, to give life to others. I mean, that's what it means to honor your father and mother. And that's what parents find with children. You know, it's not that one act of charity, but that daily kind of sacrifice in order to literally create the life of another, and finally make love possible. I mean, the people who are most miserable in this book are the people who've been brought up in a life without love.
We'll get back to honoring your father and your mother in a minute, but among the idols you cite in this chapter is the state.
Yes.
And I have to ask, all states, all the time?
I think we should always be wary of the nation and the state, especially when the nation or the state, as most states do, works very hard to create a civic religion. By that I mean a religion that fuses national and religious symbols. You know, we certainly see it among some elements with the Christian right, but you see it in every society. You know, you see it with in the Middle East. You know, it's something that has plagued religious movements. But I think that if you look carefully at the Greek and the Hebrew Bibles, that is a very dangerous form of idolatry. It comes back to this worship of self, either as the individual within a nation or a group within a nation. So, you know, I write a chapter on, obviously, on Thou Shalt Not Kill, mm-hmm. about a former platoon leader in Vietnam and his the rest of his life. He ends up becoming an Episcopal bishop, George Packard. But one of the things that he had to confront is the lie of the civic religion, the notion that we are a great and glorious nation and God is always on our side and we can do nothing but justice and we are blessed and righteous. And he had to confront, as many people who go into war zones do, his own capacity for evil, for atrocity. I think that when these people come back, they come back as almost prophets in a way. And I think we will see it with the war in Iraq. They come back to tell us something about ourselves that's extremely important, but that we often don't want to hear. And what it is that false religion, which so often, I think, gets sold to us as religion.
But all states, all the time, as the world's set up, it's established as nation states around the globe, are all idolatrous?
Well, no. But I think when you worship the state, just like you worship any institution, then it becomes idolatry. The point is to create a moral code that's independent of the dictates of the state, to establish moral courage and have conscience. I mean, we saw this, you know, letter from a Birmingham jail with Martin Luther King or mm-hmm. Gandhi and many others, where you don't depend on the state to make moral decisions for you, or on the church or the synagogue or the mosque or any institution, but you build values independent of human institutions. When you don't do that, when your values are prescribed, when you're told what is right and wrong, and you no longer make moral judgments for yourself, then I think you are kneeling at the foot of an idol.
Our guest is Chris Hedges. His new book is Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Let's begin with Charles. Charles is on the line from Milwaukee.
Hey, great show.
Thank you.
Well, I've been writing a little bit in correspondence with friends about the Ten Commandments lately because we've been studying the text in Deuteronomy where Moses comes down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments. And what strikes me is that Moses makes clear, it seems, that the Ten Commandments themselves are not the important thing. He says that, well, these commandments will not be, you know, here in heaven, that you have to ask who will go up to heaven and bring them down to us. They will not be across the sea, but rather they will be written in your hearts and on your lips, that you may say and do them. So I'm wondering to what extent the guest thinks that the commandments are only symbolic for our own conscience, and that we need to seek that relationship with God that allows us to determine an ethical course of action.
Are you telling us, Charles, that the Ten Commandments were not written in stone? We all saw the movie. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I know.
Go on, Chris. I'm sorry.
Well, I think the caller raises a good point that, you know, you can't read through the Bible, and I mean, one of the great things about the Bible is it certainly understands human nature and the human condition. You know, we all stray. We all fall victim to the impulses that the commandments warn us against, not only in committing those impulses, but having those violations committed against us. I mean, one of the most fascinating things about writing about people who have struggled on a very deep, often very painful level with one of the violations of the commandments or one of the issues of the commandments is how they didn't choose it. I mean, the commandments chose them. And I think that
As a test or as a...
Not as a test, but I mean, for instance, if, you know, you have a family or a member or a close friend or someone who's murdered, you will have to struggle, you know, very deeply with that commandment, with the issue that commandment brings up. That you had no control over it. I mean, that happened mm-hmm. outside. And I think that in many of these cases, I mean, in the case of Bishop Packard, who I mentioned went to fight in Vietnam, he never asked for the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," to dominate his life. But it certainly has, by his own admission. And I think that oftentimes when you suffer, well, the power of the commandments is that when you suffer these violations, they are often so extreme that you spend huge portions of your life trying to cope with it.
Charles, thanks very much for the call, and good luck with your research. We're talking with Chris Hedges about the Ten Commandments and his new book, Losing Moses Along the Freeway. If you'd like to join us, it's 800-989-8255 or email us, totn@npr.org. Which commandment gives you the biggest challenge? I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the Ten Commandments. Our guest is Chris Hedges. His book is titled Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. Chris, obviously the commandments mean a great deal more to you if you believe they are the literal word of God. Do you?
You know... No, in the sense that do I believe that the commandments were, or do I believe that the Bible itself is the literal word of God? I find, you know, somebody who spent, you know, most of their life with the Bible, growing up in the church and then, of course, going to seminary, I find this notion of literalism strange because it's always selective literalism. You know, I mean, look at Genesis itself. The writers of the book of Genesis, for instance, clearly thought that the earth was flat. They thought that water was both above and below it. They wrote that God created light on the first day, and that it wasn't until the fourth day that God created the sun. I don't know. You know, these writers were not trying to explain the process of creation. They were trying to explain the purpose of creation. And I think that's the power and strength of the Bible. And you know, even within the Gospels themselves, there are tremendous contradictions between the four Gospels of the life of Christ. You can believe the Bible as a literal document, but you have to do it selectively. I mean, you know, those people who claim that the Bible is the literal word of God, for instance, will pick from Leviticus the prohibitions or condemnations of homosexuality, but ignore many of the other stuff in Leviticus, you know, such as that you can't wear, you know, garments made of more than one cloth and et cetera. And, you know, if you curse your father or mother, you have to stone them. I mean, so it's a selective literalism. And I think that when we start trying to read the Bible that way, we're missing the power of it. We're missing its importance.
At the same time, you have little comfort for liberal theologians.
No. Yes. I mean, I always say that, you know, when I graduated from college, Colgate University, I moved into a housing project in Roxbury, the ghetto in Boston, the Mission Main Mission Extension housing project, and ran a church there for 2.5 years and commuted into Harvard Divinity School to go to class. And I always say that those were the 2.5 years that I learned to hate liberals, in large part because they took it upon themselves to speak for the poor, speak for the oppressed, speak on behalf of people they never met. You know, this was the days of Nicaragua and the Sandinistas, and they would all go down and pick coffee for a week and come back sort of credentialized as revolutionaries, but they'd never get on the Green Line and go over to this the appalling living conditions that the poor were living in Roxbury. We had a 60% vacancy rate, epidemic drug problem, terrible violent crime. All of the locks on the front doors were knocked off. And so I felt that the self-righteousness and the arrogance and the lack of commitment on the parts of liberals, coupled with their amazing arrogance that they could speak on behalf of the oppressed, really distasteful.
Let's get some more callers on the line. Let's go to Peter. Peter's in Watertown, New York.
Hi. Hi. Chris, very philosophical show. There's so much on both sides. Chris, are you saying that you feel that the Ten Commandments should be represented as the value system for the for our country? Do you believe that?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the commandments themselves have, for 6,000-plus years, been perhaps one of the most important guidelines for holding community together, for creating community, and that when the commandments are violated en masse, when there is no attempt to honor any of the commandments, which I think would characterize life in the former Yugoslavia during the war, which I covered, societies break down. I think that there is a tremendous truth within the commandments. But again, I'm against literalism. I'm against creating rigid rules.
You don't believe it should be separated from church and state? It should definitely be integrated?
No, I believe very firmly in the separation of church and state. I think, again, as we spoke about previously, the problem is when you fuse religion with nationalism, or you try and make the goals of the state transparent or transcendent, that you run into trouble. People who believe that they can understand the will of God and act on behalf of God are dangerous. I think there is an important element that runs throughout the current of the Hebrew and the Greek Bible of human fallibility, human sin, and that should endow us with a great deal of humility. Unfortunately, especially among absolutist, rigid religious movements, all of that humility is gone and replaced by a very frightening kind of arrogance and intolerance.
Talking about the Ten Commandments, are you alienating a lot of other types of faith that are in the United States, the Muslims?
If you look closely at every religion, I think, or most religions, let's say, it's fascinating how the ethical calls of the commandments oftentimes parallel the ethical calls of other religious groups, such as the Eightfold Path, which is known within Buddhism as the Wheel of Law. This forbids murder, it forbids unchastity, it forbids theft, it forbids falsehood, and especially covetous desire. I mean, these kinds of concepts would all be familiar to the writers of the Bible, and certainly to the authors of the Ten Commandments. Even the Egyptian Book of the Dead, when the soul enters into the underworld, he or she is asked 42, I believe it is, questions, which again touch upon. So I think that there is, God or the transcendent or whatever, various religions have struggled to understand mystery, to take the knowable world and explain it in the face of an unknowable God or an unknowable entity. And I think that oftentimes that if you look at the core ethical calls of religion, they're surprisingly similar.
Those differences can create war, which we are at war right now. We're at war, Palestinians, Israeli. I mean, the Catholics over the Protestants in Ireland, just that slight difference could create a whole travesty of conflict.
Well, but I see, having lived, 7 years in the Middle East and covered the Balkans, I don't believe those were religious wars. I think those were primarily wars built on nationalism, where religious institutions were co-opted and used to give it a religious veneer. But I don't think they were religious conflicts.
Peter, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
I wonder, Chris, we've been following a series that's published in cooperation with the New York Public Library's lecture series on the seven deadly sins. In another slight turn of mind, this could have been an essays on the seven deadly sins.
Yeah, although I don't know. There's pretty good evidence that at least many of the core demands of the commandments predate the Bible, coming out of what they call Hittite vassal mm-hmm. treaties, and that this was at its inception a real an effort to create and maintain community. I'm not sure that I think the seven deadly sins come out of the Middle Ages, but you may know better than I.
Well, they come out earlier than that, but they were interpreted by the Middle Ages. Anyway, it goes on. Let's get another caller on the line. Bruce is with us from Kalispell, Montana.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess one of the main things in the Ten Commandments I have an issue with is honor thy mother and father, and I'm kind of curious as to what your guests would say as to why they have a particular place within the text of the Ten Commandments.
It's an interesting question, because how does somebody honor a parent that has been abusive to them? How does somebody, and should they? I'm not sure that they should. And I had to confront that as I wrote that chapter, that, the behavior of all parents is not all worthy of being honored. And I think that I came down on the belief that somehow by honoring our parents, we honor the life force that created us, and that perhaps in many ways by confronting, in the case of an abusive parent, what was done to us, we honor them by not being abusive, by going on to pay homage and respect to the sanctity of life itself. But I think that's part of what's fascinating about the commandments, is that when you think deeply about them, they're not easy issues to deal with. And I think your caller, in the mm-hmm. case of that commandment, raised a very good point.
One of the things, Bruce, thanks very much.
Thank you.
In the chapter on honor your father and your mother, one of the interesting things you say is that this was not written for children.
Right. The commandments were not written for children. I think the other thing to remember about the commandments is that they were not written so they could be honored by some and not by others, that the respect that the commandments call us to carry out towards others, mm-hmm. Also implicitly imply that we should also be treated with respect. The commandments are not a call to be abused ourselves. I think it's and look, the issue of honor thy father and mother, or like every other of the commandments, I mean, that's something that all of us who have parents, we struggle, even in the best parental relationships, we struggle with the power of the parent and the role of the parent until the end of our lives. I mean, and again, it touches on something extremely deep, and something that defines who we are and how we look at the world.
In writing about your father, and as we mentioned earlier, he was a minister, you describe him opposing the Vietnam War very early. This was in a little town in upstate New York where this was bad. He was also in favor of gay rights, which was not popular either. The cutting remarks I heard about him, you write, the cutting remarks burned inside of me, fostering an anger that would see the son, unlike the father, spend his life searching out conflict and relishing the ability to strike back. Is that part of the commandments that you most struggle with, that anger?
I don't think anger is necessarily bad. I mean, St. Augustine said that hope has two beautiful daughters, and their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they don't remain the way they are. I wish, read the prophets. They're pretty angry. I think that there's a difference between being bitter and being anger. being angry. But I'm not sure that anger is always bad. Sometimes, you know, I used to come back from to the projects from Harvard Divinity School and wish that some of the people over at the Divinity School were a little more angry and a little less complacent. So I think that, you know, and certainly my first book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, was written out of a great wellspring of anger over the lies we believe and tell ourselves about war. So I think anger is not always a bad quality.
We're talking with Chris Hedges. His new book is Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Jim. Jim's with us from Kent, Ohio.
Yes, sir. I would like to make the point that the Ten Commandments don't seem particularly relevant to modern society, and that they're too flawed to be considered valid. Such as there's no commandment against rape. There's no commandment against pollution or waging war for unjust causes, as we've recently seen. So I'd like to point out that it just doesn't seem that we should give a lot of credence to it.
Well, look, I mean, if you have a commandment that says you shall not kill, if you shall not bear false witness, if you shall not covet, I think, these moral precepts, while they tend to be general, certainly are meant to establish an ethical guideline whereby unnecessary war or abuse of another. I don't know how you can read the commandments and see that somehow that would be acceptable. At least that, in my reading of the commandments, those kinds of activities would not be acceptable.
But you would not regard this as a code of law, for example.
It's not a code of law. It's clearly not. I mean, how do you legislate, you shall have no other gods before me? How does that become law? That's not what the commandments are about. That is, there are factions within the Christian right who have tried to make it that. But I don't see it. I mean, there are, other than stealing and murder, none of the commandments are incorporated into our legal system.
Well, adultery used to be. And used to be.
Bearing
false witness in some cases is.
Well, bearing false witness, which I interpreted as lying, yeah, I mean but generally, I mean the majority of the commandments are not the basis of a legal system of any legal system that I know of.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we get one more caller in. Let's go to Wilmer. Wilmer calling from Bern, Indiana. Wilmer, you there?
Hello.
Hello, Wilmer. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to comment to Jim, and also the general form here is that principles is what the commandments are about. Principles, morals, and ethics. And Jesus, the great teacher, divided those into two categories from the Old Testament. He said you love God completely with your whole soul and mind and body, and the second part is like it, you love your neighbor as yourself. And the Ten Commandments are divided in those two categories. The first four are talking about loving God, and the last six are about loving your neighbor. And if you practice love, you certainly aren't going to go and rape them. You're not going to go kill them. You're not going to go steal from them. So those are distilled into two higher ethics than any of these other points.
Yeah, I think your caller makes a good point. The first four commandments are designed to guide the believer towards a proper relationship with God. And the remaining six, these are the ones that have you shall not, deal with our relationships with others. Yeah, I mean, I think your caller is absolutely correct.
Wilmer, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
And nobody rose to the bait of calling to tell us which commandment they most struggle with. But, Chris, I'm not going to let you get off the hook. Which one do you have the most problems with?
You live your life long enough, you struggle with all of them in one way or another. Maybe you shall not kill, having spent so much of my life in war. I'm not a pacifist. You can't sit in Sarajevo during the siege of the city during the Bosnian War and not understand how residents of that city would have the right to pick up a weapon and defend themselves. On the other hand, once you embrace the poison or the dragon of war. It has all sorts of consequences. And I think that line between when you use violence and when you not, especially having spent so much of my life in violent societies, is one that I struggle with.
Chris Hedges, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Chris Hedges, author of Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. He joined us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Coming up when we come back from the break, a new report on the nation's mental health. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.